Today's episode examines a crime involving a child under the age of 12. Some details are disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. In late February of 1983, two men scavenging the basement of an abandoned building in St. Louis made a grisly discovery. In the cold dark laid the lifeless body of a young black girl, dressed only in a blood-stained yellow sweater with her hands bound behind her back. Her body was nude from the waist down, and in a final insult and desecration of her body, her killer had decapitated her. Investigators were shocked by the horrid nature of the crime, an extremely young age of the victim, determined to have been no more than 12 years old. Despite their efforts, the child's head could never be located, making identification much more difficult. Over the next 36 years, multiple investigators would dedicate their lives to trying to solve this hideous crime. Without a name, the victim was referred to as the St. Louis Jane Doe, or in some cases, Little Jane Doe. She was buried in a pauper's grave in Washington Park Cemetery, and for decades, her location was lost. In 2013, Little Jane Doe was found, exhumed, and her remains were sent for additional testing in hopes of discovering her point of origin. To this day, not a single missing persons report has ever been found believed to be linked to Little Jane Doe. Investigators struggled to determine whether or not the child was from St. Louis or even Missouri, and her past remains as unknown as her name. While no suspect has ever been officially named, police have spoken to two convicted killers with possible links to the crime. Beyond that, there is the dark possibility that the reason a missing persons report was never filed was because her killer may have been her legal guardian. Who murdered Little Jane Doe, and will her identity ever be discovered? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 90, The Horrifying Murder of Little Jane Doe. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the horrifying murder of Little Jane Doe. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at @TraceEvPod. On Instagram at Trace Evidence Podcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence. where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. Today, we look into the terrible murder of an unidentified child victim found in the basement of an abandoned building in St. Louis in 1983. This is Episode 90, The Horrifying Murder of Little Jane Doe. Monday, February 28, 1983, was a chilly morning in St. Louis, Missouri. 8-mile-per-hour winds swept over the city, and the first sign of daybreak came amidst the clouds of car exhaust and warm breath fogging out in the 30-degree weather. Most citizens that morning were bundled up against the winter cold, though meteorologists had called for a warmer afternoon, with temperatures estimated to reach a high point of 60 degrees. This would produce an unseasonably warm later half to the day, though for two men, they would have an experience that would give them a chill that even the warmest summer day couldn't thaw from their bones. Hamilton Avenue begins near Barrett Brothers Park before traveling west and then south, ending where it connects to Delmar Boulevard in the West End area of town. Along the way, Hamilton cuts through nearly 30 neighborhood roads running from east to west. Clemens Avenue begins at Enright Avenue near Ivory Perry Park, running north before making a sharp turn to the west and ending not far from its intersection with Hamilton. In February of 1983, this particular area was comprised of many brick, Victorian-style homes and apartment buildings, many of which had been previously converted, though by this time, most of the buildings had been abandoned. Broken windows lie concealed behind red boards of wood nailed into place to bar entry, though some glass panes remained intact, granting passersby a dimly lit view of the interior, the fading memory of years long since passed. As a result of the conditions in the area, many of the buildings had been popular targets for squatters and looters. Some would break into these buildings in hopes of escaping the cold evening temperatures, while others would traverse floor after floor in search of anything that might fetch a few dollars or could be used as a quick fix project. The latter was the exact reason that brought two men down into the area that morning in search of a solution. The two men were experiencing issues with their vehicle. In some places, these men have been described as searching through abandoned buildings in hopes of discovering a part they could use to fix a broken timing chain in a car. In other places, it's been said they were actually looking for a piece of pipe for their van, possibly due to an issue with exhaust. Either way, the men's search brought them down to this area of town where they would ultimately enter into an abandoned building located at 5635 Clemens Avenue. Once inside and beyond the reach of what few windows remained, the building was exceedingly dark and difficult to maneuver through, but the two men pushed on. Their search would take them across multiple floors, eventually leading down into the basement where an incinerator had once operated. The basement was colder than the upper floors had been. Once down in the basement, the men began digging through random pieces of debris, chunks of metal, splintered boards of wood, and of course, old pipes through which water hadn't flown in years. It was pitch black in the basement, and the men struggled to see even a few inches in front of their own faces. Apparently, one of the men had a lighter, which he sparked up several times throughout their search to illuminate some of the area around them. Down in the basement, the man once again produced his lighter. This time, though, he tucked the filter of a cigarette between his lips. The metal click echoed out as the fire erupted from the lighter, catching the end of the cigarette, but before the man could even take a drag, he saw a flash of something through the orange glow of flame that caught his eye. Now blinded more as his eyes adjusted back to the darkness, he took a few steps forward, holding his lighter out in front of him, and once again rolled the spark wheel, which cast a dim orange flicker upon the floor. The man's cigarette fell from his lips as his mouth opened in a gasp upon realizing what the shadowy shape on the floor was. His reaction caught the attention of his friend, who turned and joined him in staring in horror. There, beneath several pieces of debris, lay the body of an African-American female, nude from the waist down, dressed only in a yellow long-sleeve V-neck sweater and face down on the floor. However, there was no face. There was no head at all. And what remained of the victim's neck hung open with mold building up at the site where the head had been severed. After the initial shock wore off enough for the men to speak, they quickly shouted and rushed out of the building, running towards a nearby payphone to dial 911 and report the grisly scene they had come upon. Within minutes of their call, officers and detectives from the St. Louis Police Department arrived on the scene and were led down into the basement. Using flashlights and spotlights, police were able to illuminate the horrifying scene. The victim had been decapitated, though there were no signs of the head in the basement. This fact, plus the lack of blood, would lead investigators to believe that the victim had been killed elsewhere and then deposited in the basement. Due to the nude lower half, it was quickly determined that the victim was female. While the decapitation itself was disturbing enough, the more police examined the scene, the more they found to suggest what the victim's terrible last moments must have been like. The young woman's hands were bound behind her back with red and white striped nylon rope. Her yellow sweater was extensively stained with blood. Homicide detectives Herb Riley, Wayne Bender, and Joe Burgoon were on the scene and would ultimately be assigned the case. Their first thought after viewing the body was that there was a likelihood that the victim had been operating as a sex worker and had been murdered by someone who had picked her up. This theory didn't last long, though, as when the body was turned over, officers quickly noted that the victim had not yet developed breasts, and later examination by Deputy Medical Examiner Mary Case would confirm that the female victim had not yet entered puberty. This was confusing to those who had been at the scene, as the victim appeared to be around 5 feet tall, which would make her taller than average for a prepubescent child. Examination of the victim's sweater showed that whatever tag may have been stitched in previously had since been removed, making it nearly impossible to track down its point of origin. Beyond the sweater, there were no distinguishing marks, no scars or birthmarks. Her fingernails were painted, approximately 2 coats had been applied. I've seen the nails described as being both red or possibly a darker shade of pink. Further examination of the scene found few traces of blood, though the wall alongside the staircase did have a few trails of blood on it, suggesting that, as the victim was carried down the stairs for disposal, her neck had likely bumped against the wall at a few places. While this seemed to confirm that the victim had been murdered elsewhere, there was also some argument that beyond decapitating the victim, the assailant had also taken efforts to drain the blood from her remains. The victim was removed from the scene and taken down to the medical examiner's office where an autopsy would be conducted within the next week. The medical examiner's office made several determinations upon examination of the young woman's remains. Firstly, they estimated that the victim had been between the ages of 8 and 11 years old at the time of her death, standing approximately 4 feet 10 inches tall to 5 feet 6 inches tall and weighing between 60 and 70 pounds. The child's stomach contents showed that she hadn't eaten for a period of time prior to her death and had likely been starved, though her body suggested that up until the days before her death, she would have been well nourished and properly cared for. This gave investigators hope that this would make it more likely someone was actively trying to find the victim and may have filed a missing persons report. X-rays showed no signs of previous broken bones or a history of abuse. When asked about this later, Detective Burgoon stated, quote, "The killer had to be familiar with the area. It's possible she was killed by a relative or someone she knew because her head was taken off. But who knows what those killers think? Anything is possible. It could have been a stranger." End quote. Beyond that, it was determined that the child had been sexually assaulted prior to her death, and the cause of death was determined to have likely been the result of strangulation or suffocation, with the decapitation occurring post-mortem. The medical examiner stated that the victim had likely been murdered less than 5 days before being discovered. The time of death was later confirmed when studies of the mold which had grown over her neck suggested less than 5 days' growth. It was also determined that the victim's head had been removed fairly cleanly and likely by a large, sharp blade, possibly a carving knife. A 16-block search would be conducted in hopes of locating the head, which they believed could be in the area, but this search was unsuccessful. Investigators even had miles of the St. Louis sewer system searched, though this yielded no results either. Her head has never been recovered, making artist renditions or digital estimations of her facial appearance impossible to construct without a base skull to work with, nor could they examine dental records for comparison. This would make determining the child's identity even more difficult for investigators. According to the Doe Network, an examination later conducted by an anthropologist determined that the child had spina bifida occulta to her sacrum, the most common type of this particular spinal abnormality. The sacrum is a bony structure at the base of the lumbar vertebrae and connects to the pelvis. Spina bifida occulta occurs when one or more of the bones of the spine fail to seal properly, resulting in gaps or small separations in the bone. However, spina bifida occulta is actually more common than one might imagine, with many people not even knowing they have it until it's discovered during an imaging test looking for something else. Because of this, it's believed that the child likely showed no symptoms, and there is a high likelihood that neither the child nor anyone in her life would have known that she had this condition. While investigators initially considered the possibility that the child may have been killed due to an issue revolving around her medical condition, this examination seemed to determine that that was unlikely to be a cause. The child's remains were kept in the medical examiner's office while police attempted to determine her identity. Their first step was to go to local schools in hopes of finding one where they might have a missing child who fit the victim's description. Unfortunately, while this appeared to be a logical step that should have led to results, It only revealed deception and frustration. According to an article by the St. Louis Dispatch, investigators quickly discovered that school records in the area were being falsified. School administrators were essentially gaming the system. The amount of money a school received from the government was based on the number of students enrolled. In order to obtain larger sums of money for the operation of the schools, employees would keep inaccurate records suggesting that more students attended the schools than actually did. In many cases, officers came upon school records that continued to list students as being enrolled years after they'd already withdrawn from the school. This made it extremely difficult to determine what records were accurate, let alone what students may or may not have been attending these schools. Captain Leroy Adkins of the St. Louis Police Department was the first black officer assigned to run the homicide division. Captain Adkins realized early on that this case was going to be difficult, but it was exceedingly important to solve it as quickly as possible. While the sexual assault and grisly murder of the child was incredibly disturbing, and Adkins wanted desperately to pull the perpetrator off the street, he was also aware of the sensitivity of racial implications. There was little trust between the black community and the St. Louis police, with the common belief being that the department was much more focused on solving cases involving Caucasian victims, whereas other races often found their cases neglected or even ignored. While the historic Brown v. Board of Education ruling officially ended segregated school districts in 1954, the city of St. Louis had been subject to a racially discriminatory system of public and private housing, which, according to the St. Louis Public Radio, quote, made St. Louis one of the most racially segregated metropolitan areas in the country. Out of that grew a network of school district boundaries that, to this day, have divided large numbers of black students in racially separate schools as effectively as any Jim Crow law, end quote. In 1983, the same year the victim was discovered, a federal court mandated that St. Louis and surrounding suburbs participate in desegregation programs, which would see thousands of black students, regardless of the town they lived in, offered the opportunity to be bused to previously predominantly white schools at the expense of the state. While this program worked well, it was also costly and resulted in a racist backlash from white school districts where some would gather at school fences to protest the court order. This program was only pushed for a few years before the court order was closed after the arguments of local politicians, school board members, and citizens who felt the money being spent was far too much and would result in bankrupting the city. Following the ending of this court order, many of the schools began to revert back to their prior states, with the unofficial segregation continuing. Due to this racial divide between the black community, the predominantly white political leadership, and the view that the St. Louis Police Department didn't care about non-white crimes, there was an incredible gap between the police and the African American community. As a result of this, Captain Adkins was highly aware that black members of the community often did not report crimes to the police, nor did they feel comfortable participating in police investigations, making it a much greater challenge for the department to try and determine the victim's identity and origins. Several community gatherings were held, in which Adkins and other representatives of the department pled with the community to work with them and to contribute to the investigation. In a 1983 St. Louis Dispatch article, Adkins is quoted at one of these gatherings as saying, quote, somebody out there knows something. Talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends. Somewhere out there is a mother without a little girl, a brother without a sister, a neighbor without a little girl running up and down the street, end quote. Over the course of the first few months of the investigation, police began to realize the possibility that their victim was not a local. Despite the terrible conditions of the school records, although some did have immaculate records, they managed to determine that there were no young girls fitting the victim's description who were unaccounted for from those schools. Beyond that, an examination of local missing persons reports failed to come up with any report that described a victim matching the Jane Doe's characteristics or the time during which she had been missing. Outside of those records, police also worked to track down the whereabouts of more than 700 young black girls between the ages of 7 and 12 years old who lived in the area at the time and were listed on official documents showing families who had been recipients of welfare. all of those girls were accounted for. In hopes of expanding the reach of their investigation, 15,000 flyers were produced and placed on the doors of homes, in the windows of businesses, and along buildings and fence lines. These flyers, for the first time, referred to the victim as Little Jane Doe. According to the St. Louis Dispatch, investigators also mailed more than 2,000 letters to school administrators in Missouri, as well as the neighboring state of Illinois. Further letters were sent out to law enforcement agencies around the country, though there was no response regarding a possible match in missing persons files. The FBI was contacted and asked to look through their own missing persons records, and again, no matches were found. The FBI would later describe the case as being the only active case involving the decapitation of a child that young. Even immigration agencies were involved, considering the possibility that the victim may have been from outside of the United States, though again, this failed to produce any major results. Captain Adkins himself sent several letters to black newspapers and radio stations from coast to coast in hopes of bringing more attention to Little Jane Doe's murder, and at the time, a $10,000 reward was offered for information leading to her identity and the identity of her killer. Unfortunately, despite the efforts of detectives, Little Jane Doe's case was cold from the start. Hundreds of individuals were interviewed in the first few months, but not a single person was ever tied in any way to the murder. Local pedophiles were rounded up and questioned. Known sex workers were asked about anyone who may have been looking for particularly young women, and everyone from small-time criminals to murderers and murder suspects were spoken to. But no one seemed to have any information about the little girl who had been killed and dumped in a basement. Over the course of the next years, several newspapers would specify that particular individuals were under investigation for a possible connection to the murder, but none of these investigations ever led to a single charge being filed. Several months after the murder, a panicked woman ran into the St. Louis Police Department looking for help. The woman requested to speak with detectives working on Little Jane Doe's case, and when she was delivered to them, she had a disturbing story to tell. According to the Riverfront Times, the woman claimed to have encountered a man she believed to be the murderer. In her story, the woman stated that a man, who lived a few blocks from where the body was found, invited her over to his apartment. In the apartment, the woman said the man produced a machete and a human skull. Eager to find out what was going on, Detectives Burgoon and Riley, accompanied by Captain Adkins, obtained a warrant and then proceeded to the man's apartment, taking the door down with a sledgehammer. They were able to recover both the skull and the machete, though it quickly became apparent that this was not the man they were looking for. Detective Burgoon told the Riverfront Times, quote, "The machete was a novelty piece you could bend a million ways. It would never cut someone's head off. He got the skull from a high school teacher in California. It was all verified. He wasn't our guy." End quote. 10 months after the discovery, the remains of Little Jane Doe were removed from the medical examiner's office and prepped for burial. The child was placed inside of a body bag, which was then placed inside of a white wooden coffin, which was then moved to Washington Park Cemetery, a historically black cemetery located some 8 miles to the northwest of where she had been found. The funeral was sparsely attended, with the gravediggers operating as pallbearers. In attendance was Captain Adkins, Detective Riley, a representative of the medical examiner's office, and Reverend John W. Hayward, Jr. The ceremony was short and took place beneath an overcast gray sky. The Reverend prayed that an answer would be found and the child would be identified. Asked after the funeral about the progress of the case, Detective Riley stated, quote, "We're no closer today than the day I picked her up in that building. I feel strongly that the kid is from here. Doesn't anybody care about this child besides the homicide unit? I've been involved with her since the day she was found, and I'll be damned if I'm going to stop looking for her killer." End quote. Sadly, Little Jane Doe's grave was not properly marked. A gravestone paid for by student donations read, quote, "The saddened hearts were healed in knowing the pain of life is over and the beauty of the soul revealed." End quote. Unfortunately, the gravestone was placed in the wrong location. Every possible avenue to try and determine who Little Jane Doe was and who may have killed her was explored. Detectives even went so far as to consult with multiple so-called psychics. In one instance, a group of psychics came together for a seance, during which time they were given photos of the scene, fingerprints, little Jane Doe, and the sweater she had been wearing. These psychics claimed to know the location of the victim's head, which authorities followed up on, but nothing was ever found. In what can only be considered an extremely frustrating turn of events, in 1993, Detective Riley corresponded with a so-called psychic located in the state of Florida. In hopes of getting a better sense of what may have happened, the psychic requested to be able to physically touch evidence from the case. The psychic was then sent the yellow sweater that little Jane Doe had been wearing when she was found. The sweater was never returned to police, and when they questioned the psychic, he claimed to have never received it. One of the only pieces of evidence in the case was forever lost in the mail. 3 years later, in 1996, Detective Riley passed away, with little Jane Doe being one of only two cases in his entire career he'd been unable to solve, out of more than 2,000 cases. Over the course of the next 30 years, there were multiple possibilities investigated as to the identity of little Jane Doe. A police officer from the city of Charlac questioned a man who was in possession of a female skull, which he'd claimed to have bought at a souvenir shop in the 1970s, though this would ultimately be determined to have been from someone who lived long before little Jane Doe had ever been born. A woman named Sharon Nolte believed that the victim had been a Chippewa Native American named Shannon Johnson. Nolte went so far as to obtain a DNA sample from a relative, and even gathered DNA evidence from a man she believed to be the killer, but testing would later prove that little Jane Doe was not the child Nolte believed her to be, though Nolte would later argue that the test proved nothing, and she believed the St. Louis police simply didn't pursue her tip and didn't care. In July of 2004, Detectives Tom Carroll and Jeff Stone of the St. Louis Police Department began looking at possible links between little Jane Doe and any murderers in prison who may have committed their crimes using similar MOs. One name that stuck out to them was Tommy Lynn Sells. Sells had been convicted of murdering 13-year-old Kayleen Harris and attempting to murder 10-year-old Crystal Searles. Sells had slit Searles' throat, and miraculously the child survived and was able to give a description to police. Kayleen Harris was, unfortunately, not so lucky, as she was beaten, stabbed, sexually assaulted, and then murdered by having her throat cut. Sells was either linked to or claimed directly to have been responsible for crimes in several states, including New York, Massachusetts, Texas, Illinois, Kentucky, and Missouri. Despite their sincerest efforts, detectives were unable to obtain any information to connect Sells to little Jane Doe. Sells was unspecific in the interview, saying it was possible, but police felt Sells would claim responsibility for any crime put in front of him, if for nothing else, than to bolster his numbers. Sells was executed by lethal injection in April of 2014. Another name, which investigators turned their attention to, was known killer Vernon Brown, who had operated in both Missouri and Indiana. Brown had done time in Indiana in 1980 for molesting a 12-year-old. Not long after he was released from prison, 9-year-old Kimberly Campbell disappeared and was later found in a home owned by Brown's grandmother. Campbell had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death. Brown was then sought, but police couldn't locate him. He had apparently fled the state after molesting another child. A few years later, in 1985, Brown showed up as a suspect in St. Louis. 19-year-old Sonetta Ford was found murdered in her apartment, the victim of both a stabbing and strangulation. Ford's head was attached, but had nearly been severed with the use of a large, sharp knife. Brown had been working at her apartment building under an alias, and while police wanted to charge him with Ford's murder, they just didn't have enough evidence. A year later, in October of 1986, 9-year-old Janet Perkins vanished from St. Louis. Perkins had left school, walking home, but never arrived. The path Perkins took led her directly by the home of Vernon Brown. Investigators later found Perkins' body behind Brown's home. She had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death. Brown was arrested and found guilty of the murder. He would receive the death sentence. He would receive a second death sentence after being found guilty of the murder of Sonetta Ford. He would also be charged with a 1980 murder from Indiana, in which a 9-year-old girl was beaten, sexually assaulted, and strangled. In 2005, St. Louis detective Tom Carroll went to visit Brown on death row to question him about Little Jane Doe. In an interview with the St. Louis Public Radio, Carroll explained that Brown refused to speak to him, and he defined the man as cold and without emotion. When asked about the possibility that Brown could have committed the crime, Carroll replied, quote, "Personally, I believe he did it. It was his style, tying up little girls," end quote. Brown was executed by lethal injection in May of 2005. In the years since, he has been linked to 2 additional murders and is a suspect in more than 20 others. His possible involvement in the murder of Little Jane Doe remains uncertain. In 2013, detectives sought to exhume the remains of Little Jane Doe for further testing, to gather DNA, and to conduct an isotope test in hopes of determining what area of the country Little Jane Doe may have originated from. Unfortunately, locating Little Jane Doe would be more challenging than they'd imagined. Records indicated one location for Little Jane Doe's remains, while a headstone suggested another. The graveyard had ceased operations years earlier, and so much of it was in poor shape and overgrown. After accusations of poor burials and mismanagement of the cemetery, the owner committed suicide, and things only got worse. Digging began near the headstone, though this resulted in the discovery of 3 caskets, none of which contained Little Jane Doe. According to St. Louis Today, funeral director Calvin Whitaker and his wife Christina took it upon themselves to visit the cemetery in search of the grave. Utilizing photographs taken at the time of Little Jane Doe's burial, the Whitakers were able to locate an area which matched the photographs after spending countless weekends clearing away brush and studying the cemetery. Digging in the area marked by the Whitakers first revealed a bouquet of white flowers, and beneath that, a white wooden coffin. Inside of the coffin was a body bag which contained bones, and these bones were confirmed by a medical examiner to be that of Little Jane Doe. There was no skull present in the bag, and it was finally confirmed. After exhumation, her remains were sent to the University of North Texas and the Smithsonian Institute, conducting both DNA and isotope testing. The stable isotope analysis provided information which suggested that Little Jane Doe likely grew up in the southeastern United States, with 10 states being considered possibilities: Florida, Georgia, Texas, Alabama, Arkansas, Tennessee, Louisiana, Mississippi, North, and South Carolina. While this is a broad set of possibilities, it is far more narrow than previous information, which had investigators wondering whether or not Little Jane Doe was even from the country. Once all testing was completed and samples gathered, Little Jane Doe's situation was passed on to the Garden of Innocence, a nonprofit organization that works to provide proper burials for unclaimed children and infants. The garden itself is in a section of Calvary Cemetery, located on West Florissant Road in North St. Louis. Little Jane Doe was reburied in this garden, and at the time of her burial, given the name Precious Hope. This time, her funeral and burial were attended by more than 50 individuals, from law enforcement to locals who wanted to be there for the nameless child. Her former wooden casket was replaced with a white metal one, adorned on the 4 corners by brass angels. The funeral service lasted an hour and included a church choir and the playing of bagpipes. The names of all the children buried in the Garden of Innocence are inscribed on a granite marker, with Little Jane Doe being under the name Precious Hope. St. Louis Detective Dan Fox, who took over as lead investigator, attended the funeral both to be there for Hope, but also to scan the crowd, wondering if it were possible that the person who took her life may have attended. Retired Detective Joe Burgoon also attended and parroted Fox's thoughts, telling St. Louis Today, quote, "You know what they say, sometimes they return to the crime," end quote. To this day, visitors arrive at Calvary Cemetery to pay their respects to Hope. One particular visitor, posting under the name Worry-Free Philly, wrote about her experience on TripAdvisor, saying, quote, "As I walked around the well-known famous folks, all I could think of was Precious Hope. Her story moved me in a way that I can't explain," end quote. The cemetery boasts such notable people as Tennessee Williams, Dred Scott, and William Tecumseh Sherman. In the 36 years since Precious Hope was found, little if any new information has been discovered to shine light on who she is, what her life was like, and who made the grisly choice to assault, murder, and decapitate the child. In all of that time, only three theories have ever been entertained with a degree of possibility. The first theory argues that convicted killer Tommy Lynn Sells may have committed the crime, amongst dozens of others. When questioned about it, Sells only acknowledged that it was possible, but he couldn't be sure. The second theory purports that convicted killer Vernon Brown may have been responsible. He was in the area around that time, committed similar crimes, and when questioned about Hope, refused to give any answers, taking whatever secrets he possessed to the grave. The third and final theory considers the possibility that Precious Hope may have been killed by someone she knew and trusted. The removal of her head, while possibly the signature of a serial killer, could also have been done in order to conceal her identity and any link it may have had to the perpetrator. No missing persons report has ever been found which can be linked to Hope, making investigators wonder if that's because the person who could have reported it was also the person responsible. I'd like to give you more information about this terrible crime, but sadly, there's little to deliver. I can't even give details about Hope's description, because without her head, her hairstyle, eye color, and any distinct facial features are unknown. The yellow sweater she was wearing at the time of her death appeared to be new, but the tags had been removed. The red and white nylon rope used to bind her wrists had nothing about it that would make it stand out, and similar lengths of rope were available all throughout the country. All that we know for certain is that a child, no older than 11 or 12, was sexually assaulted, strangled, and then beheaded before being left in the refuse-filled basement of an abandoned building. Not a single trace of her killer has ever been found, nor has her head. And even the building in which she was found has since been destroyed and replaced with new apartment buildings in an effort to better that area of St. Louis. Many murders have happened in St. Louis since Precious Hope had her life taken from her. Some remain unsolved, but when the St. Louis Police Department are asked about the cases that haunt them the most, Precious Hope's case is always at the top of the list. Detective Riley went to his grave searching for the truth. Detective Burgoon, since retired, still thinks of Hope every day and longs for the truth to be discovered and justice to be served. Lead investigator Dan Fox is the most recent in a line of investigators who have been determined to solve this disturbing and haunting case. As of today, the truth remains obscured, but there is one fact which cannot be denied. Someone committed this heinous crime, and if alive today, they have walked the earth free of punishment for the past 36 years. While their life has gone on, Hope's was extinguished. I was 1 year old when Hope was murdered, and all I can do is imagine all of the things I've experienced in my life that she could have done, and all of the things I've done that she'll never get a chance to. And at the end of the day, I have a name, and even that was taken from her. Child cases are tough. Doe cases are tough. Child doe cases are extremely tough. The murder of a child is something I'll never understand. Maybe it's naive considering my line of work, but I'll never be able to conceive of the level of evil that must exist inside of someone that would drive them to murder an innocent child, and in such a horrifying way. I'd been asked a lot recently if I'd be doing any more doe cases, and while I planned on doing some, I wasn't sure which one. There are sadly far too many to choose from. However, I was reading about Precious Hope not long ago and made the decision that if I were going to do another doe case anytime soon, it had to be hers. I couldn't tell you what it was that just spoke to me about this particular case during the selection process, but I felt compelled. It was just so overwhelmingly sad, and there's a part of me that's very much drawn to the sadness and pain of an unidentified victim, especially a child. I can't begin to imagine the pain a parent must feel when their child is gone. Whether that's due to an abduction, a murder, an accident, or even an illness, the loss of a child is something that no one ever grows to accept or get past. A parent may be able to continue on, to transform their pain and grief into something positive for the community or other parents, but they're never going to forget or stop trying to find out what happened. How is it possible that we have a case of a young girl who's murdered, left in a basement, and there's never been a connection made to someone who may have been looking for her? It's so strange. Now, there is the possibility that someone out there reported her as a missing child, but if that's the case, no one's yet made that connection. There is, of course, the other possibility that whoever murdered Precious Hope was the same person who would be responsible for filing that missing persons report. For 36 years, Precious Hope has remained an unknown murder victim. Without an identity, there are countless avenues of investigation which cannot be pursued. Due to the fact that her head was removed and never recovered, it makes a facial reconstruction impossible. We can't even imagine what she may have looked like in life. A nameless child murdered and discarded. This is a crime that could only be perpetrated by a monster. But the sad truth is, it's not a monster. It's just a person. It could be someone living in St. Louis today, someone who walked down Clemens Avenue once in a while to remember the atrocity they committed. Whether or not this person is still alive, we simply can't know, but I sure hope so. I want this person to be alive. I want this person to be found, and I want this person to live out their final days in a dark cell deprived of freedom. In order to do that, we have to know who this person is, and right now, all we've got are a handful of theories. The first theory looks at convicted killer Tommy Lynn Sells. Sells was born in June of 1964, making him 18 years old when Precious Hope was murdered in St. Louis. Sells claimed to have committed his first murder at the age of 15, though questions remain about the details. Sells was, by the time he was 5 years old, spending a lot of his time with a man who was later identified as a pedophile, and Sells was one of the children he victimized. At 13, Sells attempted to sexually assault his mother, and a year later he fled from the family home in St. Louis and began traveling around the country. In 1979, he claims to have broken into a home, during which time he witnessed a man sexually assaulting a child, which sent him into a rage, leading him to murder the man. No evidence of sexual assault has ever been discovered in connection with that crime. Between 1979 and 1981, Sells would murder two more men and attempt once again to sexually assault his mother. In 1982, he fathered a child. In July of 83, some 5 months after the murder of Precious Hope, a witness saw a man fitting Sells' description exiting the home of Thomas and Colleen Gill in St. Louis, Missouri. Inside the home, police found Colleen and her 4-year-old daughter, Tiffany, beaten to death. 2 years later, Sells was working at a carnival in Forsyth, Missouri, some 250 miles to the southwest of St. Louis. Sells would later murder Anna Cord and her 4-year-old son, Rory, after meeting them at the carnival. Both were beaten to death with Rory's baseball bat. These details alone confirm that Sells was a violent killer who had no issues murdering young children, and that he was in Missouri between July of 83 and July of 85, minus a period of time from May of 84 to February of 85, during which time he was serving a 2-year sentence for Grand Theft Auto. He also served 8 months in prison for felony theft in April of 85. Just days before the murder of Anna Court and her son, Sells fled a rehab center after being questioned about another stolen car. Keeping track of Sells is somewhat difficult, and while investigators have established what they believe to be a fairly accurate timeline, there is no accounting for Sells' whereabouts between late 1982 and July of 1983. We know he was in Arkansas in 82, where he fathered a child, but where he was in February of 83 when Precious Hope was murdered remains unknown. But he was in St. Louis 5 months later, having murdered a woman and her daughter. So there's a chance that Sells could have been lingering around St. Louis, likely committing other crimes, and that he could have come upon Precious Hope. Sells, however, did sometimes commit post-mortem mutilation of victims' remains, and when asked directly about the murder of Precious Hope, he claimed to have murdered a black female in St. Louis around that time, though he was unable to give details that seemed to fit with this case, and there's never been anything to conclusively link him to Precious Hope. The fact of the matter is, this is a sick and disturbed individual, qualified as a thrill killer, who had experienced sexual trauma in his childhood, which seemed to bleed over into his murders. I wasn't able to find anything which showed that Sells ever decapitated a victim before and took the head elsewhere, but there is a history of him tying up victims, though for the most part, he tended to leave victims in the locations where he murdered them, unless it was outdoors, in which case he often disposed of the body elsewhere. This could have happened with Precious Hope. Ultimately, we can't know for sure if Sells is the man responsible for the murder of Precious Hope. It's a possibility that can't be ruled out, but it cannot be proven either. Honestly, when you look at Sells, it's not hard to imagine this is the type of person who would have no problem sexually assaulting and then murdering a young child. Whether or not the murder will ever be tied to him is unknown, though it seems highly unlikely given the utter lack of evidence from Precious Hope's murder. Also, for many, they consider it strange that Sells could have committed this murder, but no one in St. Louis reported Hope missing, nor did anyone come forward after she was found, leading investigators to question whether or not she was from the area. For the most part, law enforcement consider Sells a possibility, but do not believe he is the most likely. However, there is a killer they do consider a better possibility, and that brings us to the second theory. Vernon Brown was born in October of 1953, making him 29 years old at the time of Precious Hope's murder. We know, based on arrest records and court documents, that Brown's known murders took place between the years of 1980 and 1986. Of course, these are only the murders which have been confirmed. Brown was ultimately convicted of murdering 9-year-old Janet Perkins in October of 1986 in St. Louis. The details of that murder are extremely disturbing. Brown, who was home at the time with his two stepsons, locked the stepsons in their rooms and brought Perkins down into the basement, where he bound and strangled her, all while his stepsons could hear the child's screams echoing through the air ducts. Brown then disposed of the body by placing it in trash bags and leaving it near a dumpster located behind his home. When Brown was arrested for Perkins' murder, he then admitted to the murder of 19-year-old Sonetta Ford, who had been strangled and stabbed. Reports stated that Ford had been stabbed so viciously in her neck that her head had almost been severed. She was left in her apartment. Prior to the murders, Brown had spent time in an Indiana prison for molesting a child, and it's thought he may have committed another murder in Indiana before fleeing the state. 9-year-old Kimberly Campbell was found raped and strangled in a home owned by Brown's grandmother. While Brown and Sells had similar predilections towards sexual assault and murder, they were vastly different in terms of their openness about their crimes. While Sells spoke with investigators and gave details, though many of those details were false, Brown wouldn't speak with investigators at all. When St. Louis detectives went to question him about the murder of Precious Hope, he refused to say anything about it. So, looking at Brown as a possible suspect, there are certainly details that fit. Brown had a history of sexually assaulting and strangling children, as well as at least one adult. Keeping track of Brown's whereabouts can also be challenging, with documentation showing where he was in 1980, as well as 1985. However, the exact whereabouts of Brown in February of 83 have never been confirmed. I haven't been able to find anything that even mentions Vernon Brown and the year 1983. I did find accusations that Brown's two stepsons accused him of sexually assaulting them in the early 1980s, and that the children's mother had the boys examined at Cardinal Glennon Hospital in 1984. That hospital is located in St. Louis. We also know that Brown lived at 4028 Enright Avenue in 1985, as well as 3435 Washington Boulevard. Both of these locations are less than 4 miles from the building in which Precious Hope's remains were discovered. So in the early 1980s, you've got two serial killers in Tommy Lynn Sells and Vernon Brown operating within miles of the location where Hope would be found. While Sells was certainly a possibility for many, Brown is the greater possibility. While Sells killed by various methods, Brown seemed focused on strangulation. While Sells sexually assaulted some victims, Brown had a history of pedophilia and sexually assaulted his younger victims. He even did time for specifically committing sexual assault to a victim he did not murder, which could have played a role in his decision to later murder victims he sexually assaulted in an attempt to avoid being arrested again. A problem with Brown, though, is that he wasn't very smart or organized. His crimes seemed to have been those of opportunity. Whether he was enticing a child into his home during her walk home from school, or murdering a woman who lived in an apartment building that he worked at. There wasn't either much effort on Brown's part to conceal his crimes. He was ultimately caught because he left a victim's body in trash bags behind his own house. It seems like somewhat of a leap to imagine that he would have gone to such lengths to conceal Precious Hope's identity while not doing anything before or after like that. Remember, the crime he was arrested for initially was the murder of 9-year-old Janet Perkins, and he did very little to try and hide that. In fact, when he was arrested, he just confessed to murdering Ford also. This doesn't sound like a man with a plan. For most people, the detail that connects Brown to Hope so strongly is the fact that his stabbing of Sonetta Ford almost resulted in her decapitation. While that is absolutely an intriguing similarity, it's hard to connect much else beyond that. He didn't complete the decapitation, nor did he remove the head and place it elsewhere. Some might argue that he simply failed to successfully complete the task, either losing interest or because he was scared or heard someone coming, and that made him leave. Ford was murdered 2 years after Precious Hope, and so the stabbing may have been indicative of the murder of Precious Hope, but there is some argument to be made that while Brown sexually assaulted minors, he didn't do this to Ford. And his sexual proclivities may have been tied to fantasies connected specifically to children. That being said, if indeed Brown murdered Precious Hope, it's the only murder in which he removed the victim's head post-mortem and disposed of it elsewhere. That doesn't mean it wasn't him. Some killers change up their tactics from time to time. I mean, just look at Ted Bundy, for instance. Brown, much like Sells, can't be ruled out, but also can't be ruled in. There's as much to connect him to the crime as there is to connect anyone to it. He was in the area at the time, had a violent history, had targeted children for sexual assault, and favored strangulation as his method of murder. It's difficult to ignore this possibility, and while at least Detective Tom Carroll believes Brown committed this heinous crime, nothing has ever been found to make that connection. Of course, there are questions that remain, and some of those questions seem to suggest that the killer may have known Precious Hope, and perhaps believe that if she were identified, that might expose him. That leads us to the third and final theory. Let's face a difficult fact here. Unfortunately, Precious Hope could have been murdered by almost anyone. It's far too broad to go down that road, besides saying that that possibility exists. For many, though, they believe that the crime may have been committed by someone who knew Precious Hope, and perhaps even someone who was legally responsible for her well-being. We know based on the autopsy that Hope was well-nourished and in good shape, with no signs of former physical trauma or abuse. Her nails were painted. The sweater she wore didn't appear to be cheap or frayed. Investigators have said time and again that it's clear someone, at some point, cared about and took care of Hope. So why isn't there a missing persons report? A parent or guardian who takes care of a child isn't just going to turn on a dime and commit such an atrocious crime. Especially without a history of abuse. This just doesn't seem likely. But maybe it is. I want to quickly discuss a case which parallels Precious Hope's in several ways. On April 28, 2001, the decapitated remains of a young African-American girl were found near Hibbs Park in Kansas City, Missouri, 250 miles to the west of St. Louis, 18 years after Precious Hope was killed. 3 days later, on May 1st, the unidentified victim's head was found wrapped in a trash bag about 200 yards from where the body had been found. It was ultimately determined that the child had been beaten with an ashtray, kicked and hit, and then decapitated while she was still alive. Being that she was unidentified, she was given the name Precious Doe. Much like the case of Hope, there was no missing persons report. There was nothing to suggest what the victim's identity may be, nor the reason behind such a brutal murder. 4 long years would pass, and on May 5, 2005, Precious Doe was identified as 3-year-old Erica Green from Oklahoma. Green's mother, Michelle Johnson, and her stepfather, Harold Johnson, were arrested in connection with her murder. Erica was one of 9 children, the other 8 of whom were taken into state custody upon their parents' arrest. Harold Johnson was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life, after the prosecution displayed to the jury how he had beaten the child and then removed her head using hedge clippers in hopes of concealing her identity. Michelle Johnson was given a sentence of 25 years in prison for testifying against her husband. For many people who had been looking at the murder of Precious Hope, this seemed like a very similar scenario. A young child decapitated, no missing persons report, nothing to indicate who the child was. It was clear once the arrests were made that the decapitation had occurred in an attempt to distance Harold and Michelle from the crime. For whatever reason, they left the head near the body, which seems counterintuitive since the head had been removed for a reason. Why it was left behind has never really been all that well explained. Either way, it made sense to investigators as much as something this sadistic can make sense. It was all about concealing identity. So, for a lot of people, the fact that Precious Hope was decapitated in conjunction with the lack of a missing persons report could also suggest that she had been killed by a parent or guardian. Except in this case, whoever committed the crime placed the head somewhere it has never been located. So is it possible that Precious Hope could have been killed by a parent or guardian? Sadly, yes. The question becomes how someone is able to conceal the fact that their child is gone, especially after the discovery of Precious Hope. You'd imagine some people who knew the family would be asking questions. Imagine your neighbor has a child, and then you never see that child again, and a body is discovered later of a child of the same age. It seems difficult not to make that connection. However, we also have to look at the situation with Erica Green. Her parents drove from Oklahoma to Kansas City to dispose of her remains in hopes of distancing themselves further. That certainly could have happened here. We know from the isotope testing that Precious Hope may have been from any number of states, none of which are Missouri, depending upon the accuracy of the isotope test. Assuming it's accurate, that confirms investigators' beliefs that Precious Hope was not a local. The question becomes, what if she was a local, but a new local? If you're living in one state and you move away, the people in the state you knew know your daughter. If during that move you murder that daughter and dispose of her remains when you arrive in your new town, no one is going to know you had a daughter, so no one's going to ask questions. That certainly could have happened here, whether that new town was St. Louis, another city in Missouri, or somewhere else along the way. The problem I have with the idea that this could have been from someone outside of St. Louis is that her remains were found in the basement of an abandoned building. Usually, if you are not from an area, you don't exactly know where to go to find abandoned buildings, and you're not likely comfortable disposing of a body in an area you're not familiar with. You want to know the comings and goings, you want to ensure no one's going to see you, and it's unlikely someone's going to find the body. Those are the things that you're targeting to try and protect yourself from being arrested. I mean, let's face it, if you murder someone, perhaps even your own child, you want to dispose of the body in a way in which it can't be identified. So you remove the child's head, believing this will make identification more difficult. Why would you then put the body in the basement of an abandoned building in an unfamiliar city when you could easily have disposed of it in any number of bodies of water, garbage dumps, wooded area? It's not as if the country is in short supply of remote locations. I suppose there's the possibility that whoever placed her remains in the basement didn't live in St. Louis, but may have in the past. This may have been an area they were familiar with. I could see that being a possibility. The problem with this being apparent, at least in my eyes, is twofold. No history of physical abuse, but we know the victim was sexually abused. Now, I'm sure there are messed up parents out there who don't beat their children but do sexually assault them. I suppose that could be the case here. We really have no way of knowing whether or not this was the first time that Hope was sexually abused. I guess you'd have to wonder what led to this child being murdered. Assuming the child is with a parent or parents who are sexually abusing her, but otherwise doing what is necessary to take care of her, what pushed things over the edge? That's an answer we may never have, unfortunately. There is, of course, a few possibilities. Hope's parents could have died, leaving her in the custody of someone else. If that someone else committed this crime inside of a certain window of time, maybe no one would notice. Or maybe this person was visiting another city and then took Precious Hope back to his home of St. Louis, where no one was the wiser that he or she had a child, and then committed this crime for whatever particular reason insane people do things like this. There's also the possibility that one or both of Hope's parents could have been some kind of an addict or in some kind of debt, at which time the child was taken as payment or sold off for drug money, But that would seem to contrast with the idea of her being well-nourished and taken care of. The fact is, there's a lot of possibilities here. A parent, a friend, a neighbor, someone who was able to get their hands on this child either without a report being filed or her absence being noticed. Precious Hope was somewhere between 8 and 12 years old, and assuming that her life was somewhat normal prior to the horrifying events that led to her murder, somewhere there's a record of this child's birth, attendance at school, something. There's the possibility that a report was filed and has never been matched up. There's also the possibility that she was murdered by a parent or guardian who did not file a report. I'd be interested in knowing about suicides which took place within a week or two of Hope's murder in the St. Louis area. If you're dealing with someone who may have been suffering from a drug issue or mental health issue, then it wouldn't surprise me if after a crime such as this, if indeed conducted by a parent or guardian, that the killer may have taken his own life. Sadly though, while the parents or guardians are absolutely a possibility, much as is the case with Sells and Brown, we simply don't have enough information to know anything for sure. Precious Hope was murdered 36 years ago, sexually assaulted, decapitated, and left in the basement of an abandoned building which is no longer there. The investigators who worked her case from the first day have since retired or passed away. Her case continues to be investigated, but at this point, authorities have hit a wall. Hopefully, new technologies will open doors to further possibilities. Her exhumation and the gathering of mitochondrial DNA along with isotope testing does bring things further along, and while not too specifically, they have now narrowed some of the possibilities in terms of her point of origin. Someone out there is missing a child. Someone had a daughter, spent at least 8 years raising and taking care of her, and then she was gone. Whether someone abducted her, a parent committed the crime, or a trusted friend was involved, we don't know. But someone should have noticed this child wasn't there anymore. Certainly someone could have lied. She went to live with her mother, or she went to live with her father, or grandparents, or whatever the case may be. Frankly, if you were around in 1983 and you knew anyone who had a black little girl, and all of a sudden that little girl wasn't around anymore, it might not hurt to at least give the St. Louis police a call or drop an email. You never know what information you could have that could lead to a solution to any number of unsolved cases out there. We're talking about a child who was assaulted, murdered, decapitated, and left in a basement like refuse. Take the chance, send an email, make a call. Something that takes 5 minutes out of your day could solve a mystery that has haunted a city for nearly 40 years. Without further information, new technologies allowing the discovery of an identity, or someone placing a call or directly coming forward with details, sadly, the murder of Precious Hope will remain open, unsolved, and growing cold. If you're looking for more information about the murder of Precious Hope, there are many news articles and forums online with information about this case. St. Louis Online and the Post-Dispatch have many articles examining this case. You can also pull up Precious Hope's case on NCIC under the case number U47002710. With NamUs, her case number is 3199, and with NCMEC, her case number is 1104360. If you have any information about the murder of Little Jane Doe, Precious Hope, please contact the St. Louis Police Department at 314-444-5822 or the St. Louis Medical Examiner's Office at 314-622-4971. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. What app are you using to listen to podcasts? I've been using the Himalaya app, and I really love the setup. It's so much easier and streamlined than many others. But there's an added bonus with Himalaya. Through the app, you can become a supporter of Trace Evidence. Without even having to leave the app, you can sign up for a small monthly fee that goes directly to production costs for the show. And in return, You'll receive ad-free episodes and access to upcoming monthly bonus premium episodes. If you'd like to test this out, visit Himalaya.com/trace evidence and use the promo code evidence for 1 month free. Once you get used to ad-free episodes and bonus content, you won't want to turn back. As some of you are aware, on Patreon, I will begin posting one episode per month that is not available in the normal feed beginning in September. In these episodes, I'll discuss a variety of cases, including solved cases, which are voted on monthly by patrons. These episodes will also be available through the Himalaya podcast app for those who become premium members. But speaking of Patreon, it's time for a shout out to our amazing Patreon producers: Angie Dodd, Emily Smith, Megan Cotter, Kate Alexander, Chandra Moreau, Robbie Blue, Brian Kemmerling, Wannabe Sleuth 2, Laura Dickinson, Julia Rexon, Diane Dyson, Tom Archer, Eamon Brady, Nick Mohar Schurz, Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Randy Wyland, Brittany Bivens, Glenda Piper, and Megan. You're all amazing, and if you're new and I mispronounced your name, just shoot me a message and I'll correct it. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence, and for all your nice comments on social media. They've meant a lot to me these last couple of weeks. I'm going to leave you with a promo for an amazing podcast called Targeted. You should absolutely check it out. Aside from the episodes being incredibly well done, the host, Mo, is just such an amazing person. So I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
Welcome to Targeted, True Crime, Domestic Violence. We tell stories of those who were targeted by domestic abuse and investigate cases of family violence, using academic research to interpret the events. As a college professor, I think we need to stop making family violence a secret. It's time to tell our stories, use our experiences to help, heal, and provoke change. Targeted discusses sensitive information about abuse. Details may be graphic, and listener discretion is advised. I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted.